Welcome. This is Your Call. I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, who's on vacation. Back in 1997, today's guest, Dr. Beverly Tatum, a psychologist, published a landmark book on race in America. It was called, rather provocatively, I think, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? That book title came from a question that she was asked frequently in her years of holding workshops on racial identity in racially mixed schools. But if you look around any racially mixed school today, you will still see Black, white, and Latinx youth sitting together. So, has this become a situation of self-segregation? Is it a coping mechanism? Or is this an indication of larger issues that remain in play in our country? Dr. Tatum argued back then that open and honest discussions about race are essential if we're going to address the persistent racial and ethnic divides in the country. Take a listen. Here she is in 1997 as a panelist on President Bill Clinton's first town hall meeting on the issue of race.
That we all have to be willing to take that leap of faith, I think, to risk some discomfort, because these conversations are not comfortable usually, and we should just anticipate that, and that sometimes we do say things that are offensive to others, not because we want to, but because we've been breathing in that smog. You know, as I like to say, if you breathe in enough smog, occasionally you're going to cough some up, you know, and that we are all smog breathers in that way. But that it is possible for us to engage in this kind of honest dialogue if we're willing to take the risk to do it. So I think it's wonderful that all these people have gathered here for that purpose.
Well, that was 20 years ago. And now, 20 years later, Dr. Tatum is out with a new, revised, and updated version of her influential book. So how has the nation's conversation about race shifted in the past few decades? And how have federal policies maybe created hyper-segregated communities? And why did our concerted efforts at desegregation seem to fail so miserably? We're fortunate to have Dr. Tatum in the studio today to discuss these issues. She is President Emerita of Spelman College, and she is the 2014 recipient of the award for Outstanding Lifetime Contribution to Psychology. That is the highest honor presented by the American Psychological Association. Dr. Tatum, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Renee.
I've been looking forward to it for weeks because you are at the intersection of being an African American, being a female, being an academician, having a historical knowledge of the issue. And so bringing all of those things together, you're just the perfect person to talk about this subject, especially in these days. You said in that clip that it's a very uncomfortable conversation to have about race. It was not comfortable then, and it seems like it's even less comfortable now. Is that your take?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I reflect on hearing that clip back in 1997 was that President Clinton, who was the president at the time, of course, when he launched that town hall meeting, started it off by saying that this was the right time, meaning 1997 was the right time to have a conversation about race because we were a nation at peace, the economy was expanding, generally things were good in the country, people were feeling good, and he said it's at the times when you have the energy, that kind of psychological energy when things are good, to take on tough topics. That's what he said in introduction. Fast forward 20 years, 2017, we're a nation at war. The economy has been contracting in ways that have made people feel quite anxious following the recession of 2008. And we are in a different way of communicating with social media now so prominent, where people are sending off messages in 140 characters or less. And the willingness to engage in these uncomfortable conversations seems to be at an all-time low.
And if we're going to do some comparing and contrasting, the difference between a President Clinton in 1997 and a President Trump in 2017, who, just to go with the current events, tweeted just recently about Muslims. And so just talk about that a little bit. Can you just talk about the difference?
Sure. Well, one of the things I write about in my book is the importance of leadership. One of the things we know about human beings is that we are intend to, our brains are primed to categorize. We think in categories, and one of the most fundamental categories is us and them. Yet, as human beings, we look to our leaders, our parents at home, our teachers at school, the leaders of our nation, to help us know who the us is and who the them is. And when you have a leader who defines the us in a very inclusive way, we are inclined to embrace people who are different from ourselves if we are being defined as all of one country, for example. But if you have a leader who thinks in categories and defines us very narrowly and talks about them with whoever the them is with negative language and stereotypical images, then we are inclined to follow that example, and it heightens a sense of threat from those them, however that's being defined. And so when we look at, for example, some of the tweets yesterday, Donald Trump's tweeting images that came from a hate organization in Europe, that certainly underscores a sense of the other in ways that are not helpful to bringing together a very diverse society here in the U.S.
Mm. There's so many current events that may have a racial component. Representative Conyers and Nancy Pelosi's request, now that he stepped down, is there a racial component to that? Is there a racial component to the NFL players taking a knee and the president's reaction to all of that? So there's so much. It's such a fraught issue now, and it has so many tentacles that I'm hoping we can revisit some of those issues. But first, I want to just kind of take you back 20 years ago when you first wrote the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria and Other Conversations About Race? You were on that panel with President Clinton. Looking back now, what are your thoughts about the difference? I mean, you talked about the fact that the country was prosperous and more likely to be feeling inclusive. Are there any other things that have changed in the interim?
Well, there are some things that have changed in the interim, and certainly one of those things is our demographic population. We can reflect on the fact that I was born in the 50s, and back then the U.S. population was 90% white. Fast forward to 2014, 60 years, I was born in 1954, so 60 years later in 2014, that was the first year that the K through 12 population, the school age population, was 50% or more children of color. So if you think about just that change, it's quite dramatic. We live in a much more diverse society, and that change has been largely the result of immigration, and I'm not talking about undocumented immigration. Legalized immigration and differential birth rates have created a society that soon will not have a majority of any one group, will be truly a pluralistic society. And that change causes some anxiety for those who are used to being in the 90%. For those of us who have been in the minority, seems like a business as usual, but for some people, it certainly has been perhaps threatening, and I think we see that anxiety reflected in some of the concern about immigration today, and also what we can say about schools, which is an important point to make, is that even though our demographics have become much more diverse, our schools remain still highly segregated. So that diversity is not reflected in the daily lives of most school children. Most white children are still going to majority white schools. Most black and Latinx children are concentrated in schools where there are very few white students and often where there's a high percentage of low-income and poor children.
Well, if we're looking for some of the reasons around the free-floating angst that's out there, I guess one of the statistics that was in your book, which, by the way, it had like 32 pages of bibliography, extraordinarily well-researched, and yet it read like a narrative, so it was really compelling. But you write that about 8,000 people every day come to the country, and 90% of them are people of color. I could see where that might set off a panic for those who are, as you said, accustomed to being in the majority.
Yes, well, certainly our population grows by about 8,000 people. Some of that has to do with births, right? And some of it having to do with immigration. But of those 8,000, approximately 7,000 of them, as you've just said, are people of color.
And you also say that most black kids attend a segregated school. In fact, you also write that it's like 75% of black kids attend a segregated school. How did that happen, given all the efforts to desegregate schools?
Sure. Well, if you look at the history of school desegregation in the United States, it was slow to get started after Brown versus Board of Education. Certainly, southern states were very slow to desegregate initially. Northern states were not required to because they were not being court-ordered in the way that the southern system, which was clearly a segregated whites-only, you know, for colored people system, to use the language of the time. But when President Johnson became president, one of the things he did was to enforce those desegregation orders and essentially threaten the southern states with loss of funding from the Department of Education. And there was a fairly rapid desegregation after that, going through the 70s, largely using busing as a system. When President Nixon came to power, he had the opportunity to appoint 4 Supreme Court justices. And when he made those appointments, he appointed people who were generally philosophically opposed to busing as a school desegregation strategy. And there were a number of court cases at the Supreme Court level that undid or unwound some of those desegregation plans. Those decisions in the late 70s, early 80s started to unravel the process of school desegregation, which has continued with decisions as late as 2007, a Supreme Court decision that basically said you can't take race into consideration when you're making school assignments at the in the public school systems, K through 12. And if you can't pay attention to race, you can't then set goals for desegregation. It makes it very difficult for school districts to begin to use strategies like magnet schools or others to help desegregate. All of these decisions have chipped away at the meaning of the Brown versus Board of Education back in 1954. And so today we find, for that reason and other reasons having to do with white flight out of neighborhoods where school desegregation is taking place, that we once again have schools that are highly segregated.
And once again, that kind of brings us forward a bit, given that President Trump has been furiously getting federal judges with lifetime appointments approved.
Yes.
Something like 58 at the same time in his presidency. I think President Obama had appointed maybe 6. So there is a furious pace of getting these judges' seats filled with people who are ideologically aligned in his own image. And so, and not to mention Neil Gorsuch on
right.
the Supreme Court. So can you extrapolate based on what happened in the 70s and the results of that looking out the next 20 years?
Well, it certainly does raise questions as to what kind of legal progress can be made to create a more equitable society. If we look at, for example, one of the things I write about in my book is the impact of the 2013 Supreme Court decision gutting the Voting Rights Act. The protections that were put in place in 1965 when the Voting Rights Act was passed have largely been removed, and what we have seen in the last several years has been an increased effort to suppress voting or make it more difficult for those marginalized groups that were historically denied the right to vote. Those policies have made it more difficult, whether it's voter ID laws or other kinds of systems in my own state of Georgia, reducing the number of early voting days, making it harder. The numbers of places you can go to get the ID you need to vote have been closed, particularly in communities with a high population of people of color. Those are just a few examples, but certainly we know that those Supreme Court decisions have an impact, and certainly the lower level appointments have an impact too. District level appointments have an impact because that's often where case law is being decided. It's frightening to me as someone who cares about social justice to watch this happen.
This is one of those subjects that people are talking about everywhere you go. So I know that our listeners would like to ask you some questions. Dr. Tatum is here. 866-798-8255 is the number. You can drop us an email at yourcallradio.org or post a web comment on yourcallradio.org. Dr. Tatum, it appeared to me just in the way that you constructed the book that you were describing sort of a domino effect. So when you look at the disparities in Black and Latinx neighborhoods and predominantly white neighborhoods, there's a reason that there's that disparity, and it's not just that one group isn't trying hard enough. Almost a systematic disinvestment, the availability of mortgage loans, the terms of those loans, the flight of taxes. Can you just talk about that domino effect?
Sure. Well, one of the things that is important for readers to understand is that this book is really about an understanding of what racism is, how it operates in our society, in the past as well as in the present. Ultimately, how that impacts how we think about ourselves and other people, and in its conclusion, what we might do about it. And so it was important to me to include historical information about policies and practices around housing, for example, because often people will say, well, you know, people live in these neighborhoods because they choose to, or people come together because they want to. And there may, in fact, be some personal choice in the neighborhoods someone wants to live in, but it's also very important to understand the policies and practices that forced Black people into neighborhoods as they were migrating from the South during the Great Migration, sequestering, essentially, people into a particular geographic region where they weren't able to rent in other neighborhoods because of either rental exclusion or racial covenants that prevented people from buying houses in certain neighborhoods. Those racial covenants existed in California as well as in places like Chicago and New York and other places.
As recently as in the 80s even, right?
Well, they were made illegal, actually, before the 80s, but certainly the practice has continued in terms of racial steering. We know that housing discrimination is illegal, yet we know from surveys that have been done as recently as the 2000s that those practices still are in place in terms of what people do, even though they should not, you know, legally it's not allowed. The practice remains, and it's a hard thing to prove. One of the changes in Supreme Court law, Supreme Court decisions, has just made it more difficult for people to bring cases of discrimination forward because of the level of proof you need.
You know, I think part of, at least this is my theory, tell me what you think. How do you explain Americans who voted sometimes twice for Barack Obama and then found a viable candidate in Donald Trump? My theory is that many of them felt, you know what, I'm not racist. But I do see that I live in a middle class, maybe lower middle class neighborhood. I don't seem to be able to climb out of debt. My job is going overseas. And when I have my options of where I want to live, when I look at African American and other minority communities, I don't want to live there because I see that there is a process of disinvestment. And so can you blame me if I don't want to be in that circumstance? And if you keep calling me racist, I'm going to find a candidate who understands my plight and doesn't see this in racial terms and through racial eyes. Is that a viable explanation, do you think?
Well, I certainly think what you've just laid out in terms of how someone might be thinking about their own situation and what they see as being in their best interest as certainly an argument that we can hear articulated by people when they are asked, why did you vote in a certain way? Or, but what I think is really important is for us to recognize that the issue of, you know, labeling behavior as racist is perhaps not the most important issue. What I often say, because I do think many people get quite defensive if you suggest that something they are doing is racially motivated. But if we understand that we live in a society that has been infused with racial ideology from its beginning, if you think about, you know, the history of the encounters of the white Europeans and Native Americans, the imposition of slavery in the early days, the racial hierarchy that was built into Jim Crow, the policies and practices that we've been talking about that still operate today, what we know is that racism is a part of all of our everyday experience. And so the question, as I talk about in the book, should not be, are you, quote, racist? The question I think is most important is, are you actively working against racism? If we know, I use an analogy in the book where racism is described as kind of like a moving sidewalk at the airport. Imagine that. We're walking on that, we're standing still on that moving sidewalk. And we might not think of ourselves as being actively racist, but because there are these policies and practices that are carrying us all along, if we just stand still, we still get carried to that same inequitable destination. If we don't want to go there, we have to turn around. But if we just turn around, we're still traveling in that direction, just going backwards, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to interrupt that cycle, what you have to do is walk actively in the opposite direction. You have to walk actively, not just, you know, stroll along backwards, but you have to walk actively in a way that really interrupts the progress of that system of advantage that's been so baked into our society. And I think that's what many people struggle with. If you're not aware, you know, imagine that moving sidewalk was going so slowly that you didn't even really feel the motion. You might not even be aware that it was operating. But once you become aware of it, you have to work actively against it if you want to interrupt the cycle.
I love the analogy, but I also know what it's like to try to run backwards in the opposite direction when you're on that moving sidewalk. I love the analogy, but it kind of brings up the possibility of a sense of futility at some point where people just become tired of running in the opposite direction when the force and the momentum is so strong in the opposite direction. I love that analogy. I want to invite folks to email us your call at kalw.org or give us a call, 866-798-8255. We're talking to Dr. Beverly Tatum. She's the author of the book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Questions Around Race. It's a compelling discussion, and it couldn't be more timely. And when we come back, we're going to discuss the fact that when your first book was written 20 years ago, millennials weren't even born yet. They've grown up knowing a black president. And the impact of some of the things that are happening in the country on the new generation is going to be the topic of our conversation when we come back. Stay with us. Welcome back. For those of you just joining us now, I'm Renee Kemp, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting the show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and there you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. And we love it when you have show ideas for us. You can drop us a line at yourcall@kalw.org or give us a call at 866-798-8255. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a conversation on the weekly media roundtable. We'll be talking net neutrality and media consolidation and the implications of that. Today, we're talking with psychologist Dr. Beverly Tatum about her revised and updated book. It's called Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race. Dr. Tatum will be speaking this Friday, tomorrow, at Books, Inc. in Berkeley at 7 o'clock. And you can get details on that event at yourcallradio.org. So, Dr. Tatum, I'm wondering, given that there is a whole millennial generation that may not have the historical context of some of the things that you've been talking about that have led to where we are today. What is your hope for that generation?
Well, let me start by saying that it was really that generation that inspired me to do this updated and revised version of my book, because in my role as a college president, I certainly had a lot of opportunity to engage with young people who were born in the late 90s, early 2000s, and I was aware that their view of the world is shaped by a different set of events than the view that I grew up with. For example, if you were born in 1997, when the year my book was originally published, you were 4 years old in 2001 when 9/11 happened. And you might not remember that event because you were only four, but certainly your life experience post 9/11 was shaped by what was happening in the country in response to it. If you were 11, born in 1997, you were 11 in 2008 when the economy crashed, and that might have introduced a whole new level of economic anxiety into your family life, maybe foreclosure of your home or unemployment of your parents, depending on how you were situated at that time. A little bit later in that same year, 2008, President Barack Obama was elected for the first time. And even though there were plenty of people who didn't vote for President Obama, there was a survey done by USA Today right after the election, and many people said that that was a moment of pride for them, whether they voted for him or not, because it said we as a country had made progress relative to race relations, that we could elect a black man as president. Yet right after his election, there has been a spike in hate crime activity, and even that weekend, a spike in registrations on hate sites on the internet. So we know that if you're a young person, you're 11 years old, you've grown up in your teen years seeing a black man and his family in the White House, that gives you one message about what race and race relations are like in the United States. And yet, most people in this generation have said that they've seen and witnessed acts of bias. And in fact, just a few years later, 2012, we saw the murder of Trayvon Martin and the racially polarizing effect of the acquittal of George Zimmerman following his trial. A couple years later, 2014, now you're a young person, 17 years old, and you see and read about on the news Michael Brown's murder in Ferguson and the eruption of Ferguson and the arrival of Black Lives Matter on the consciousness of the nation. And so you, at a 17-year-old, you're trying to process all of this. And then 2 years later, 2016, we have this very divisive rhetoric as part of the presidential election. And in 2017, maybe you're just turning 20, and the Charlottesville events are happening with neo-Nazis marching in the street. It's a very confusing time for a young person trying to make sense of race relations in the United States.
Well, when you put it like that, that does make you understand that this generation of young people have had a completely different experience. So, but black kids are still sitting together in the cafeteria. Then and now, and I'm going to take a call because that's what the question for Jackie in San Francisco is, and her question has to do with that kind of sort of self-segregation. Hi, Jackie. Thanks for joining us.
Yes. Good morning, Renee. Thank you for this program, and I love Rose Aquilar. Dr. Tatum, thank you. Keep writing, and thank you for revising your book. I read the original one. I want to ask you two questions. There's a popular Stanford study that's showing for the past 20 years or more, African Americans are still advancing more than they did before because, you know, they're going to schools with other races. Have you found that to be true? Are you familiar with this Stanford study?
I'm not familiar with the particular Stanford study you're referencing, but certainly we know that the numbers of young people of color, African Americans included, going to college have increased dramatically. And that is one of the positive things that's happened. Certainly we know that colleges and universities are much more diverse today, despite the fact that K through 12 education is more segregated. Higher education is much more diverse in terms of student population than it ever was. And part of that, one of the challenges of that is that you have young people coming from home institutions, which were fairly non-diverse, coming into, you know, fairly segregated, coming into college and universities that are more diverse without having had the experience of learning how to engage effectively across lines of difference. So one of the things I write about in the book, which I think is really important, is that we have to take full advantage of the college environment to help educate the next generation of leaders about how to engage effectively across lines of difference if we're going to see positive change in our society.
And you had a second question, Jackie?
The second question is Mudbound. Everybody in America should see Mudbound. One of the problems I have, I am a music culturalist. I have studied the interrelationship of music and culture on four continents out of the seven. One continent doesn't have any music except the Antarctica, except where people belong there. And as an African American with that generalized and academic knowledge, I have dealt with racism in this country all my life. Did you see the movie Mudbound?
I haven't, but I'm certainly putting it at the top of my list for your recommendation.
It shows you that we are dependent on each other. The average American doesn't understand that. They don't have that knowledge and that wisdom because segregation is so embedded in our culture, in our institutions. It began like that. So until people understand, black people are no different from Chinese, Japanese, any white people, anybody else. We need each other until we stand up for each other as human beings. To give you an idea about why children sit together, I'm sure you understand this in schools. I am a senior. The senior places in San Francisco are very well segregated. They had a senior citizen program. Renee Camp was talking about it. I called to explain. I was threatened to be thrown out of a senior center because I had to protect myself against derogatory remarks while white man was stealing, and the manager constantly worked with him at the end of that program.
I actually remember that call. I remember that senior citizens program. And so there's a, thank you, Jackie, from San Francisco. Appreciate that. And there is an issue of whether young people are segregated and the extent to which that continues throughout life. Have you found that to be the case?
Yes. Well, first of all, let me just say that I think it's important for the listeners to understand that there is value sometimes in sitting together because it can serve as a protective buffer against the racism of the wider society. So I don't want the readers to suggest, while we talk about the value of engaging across lines of difference, there's also strength that can come from connecting with someone who understands your experience. And particularly when young people are teenagers, they're often looking for that shared experience. That said, I think it is really important to understand that if you grow up in an isolated, segregated environment, you're likely to continue in one. There's a statistic in my book that references white adults who are the most racially isolated of every group in the United States. 75, according to a recent survey done in 2013 by an organization called PRRI, a very reputable polling organization, 75% of white adults have social networks that are entirely white, meaning they don't have a network of friends of color. They don't live in a community with people of color. They don't work with people of color. And one of the consequences of that is a limited understanding of other people's experiences. So I come back to my point about the college opportunity. Those 4 years when young people are in college is an opportunity. Not everybody goes to college, of course, but for those who do, it is an opportunity to connect with people whose life experiences has been different from your own, and that provides valuable information as you develop your capacity to be successful in an increasingly diverse society.
So you argue that there are adverse effects, not just for people of color, but for Caucasians as well, when there's not enough interaction.
Well, if we recognize the fact that our society is increasingly diverse, it is in all of our interests to be able to understand how to connect with people whose life experience has been different from our own. If we feel like we can only connect with people who are similar to ourselves, it certainly reduces our capacity to engage, not only in the diversity of the United States, but in an increasingly global economy, it places you at a disadvantage. We also know social psychology tells us that diverse teams are more successful in terms of effective problem solving than homogeneous teams. So if I'm an employer, I'm going to want a diverse workforce so that my problem solving skills on my work team will be enhanced.
Let's take an email from Kevin. He says he appreciates the history that you offered about busing termination and the impacts that that had. Kevin's question is, what are your thoughts on income disparity and gentrification and those implications of race? And also, Kevin wants to know, what are your thoughts on programs like what's called KIPP, K-I-P-P, in San Francisco? Don't know what the acronym means, but he indicates that it opens schools in black communities that then go about culling the best students from predominantly black schools, leaving remaining low-performing students, causing the school to have the school that's left behind to have dismal scores. And he goes on to say, people think that this hurts the best students by not allowing the programs to enter the community. Do you have thoughts on that, siphoning students?
Well, I am familiar with the KIPP schools, and they are charter schools that operate across the country. There's a network of KIPP schools operating across the country. What I know about them is that the children who attend those schools tend to graduate at a higher rate. They are often kids of color, often from low-income communities, but the KIPP data suggests that those children are being well served. Now, I understand the question that he's asking, which is, are they cherry picking? You know, are they skimming talented kids off the top and therefore depriving the public schools that remain? And that is, of course, an important question. Every child should have access to a school that provides them the opportunity to learn well and go on to graduate. But I can't criticize the KIPP schools for the fact that they are, in fact, graduating young people at a very high rate. They're going on to college. When I was president of Spelman College, we often had KIPP students, graduates from KIPP schools, come to Spelman, and they did very well. So certainly if I were a parent, I would be looking for a school where my child could be successful. And the challenge in our society is not, you know, what's KIPP doing? What are we doing collectively to ensure that every child has access to a high-quality school?
And he also mentions, in effect, gentrification and the fact that when hyper-segregation occurs, that there is an impact on everything from housing values to the quality of education in the schools that are left behind. So do you have thoughts on that?
I do, actually. You know, I live in Atlanta, and one of the things that I'm involved in as a citizen in Atlanta is an effort to revitalize an underdeveloped community known as the West Side. And certainly the challenge of gentrification is a daily reality for those of us who are working in schools and trying to help communities empower themselves. Because as you know, if you have a better school, if the school gets better, then more people want to live in that community. That drives the prices up. And then the people who've been living there for, you know, all that time trying to improve their community sometimes feel forced out. Not feel forced out, are forced out by rising tax base, rising tax rates, rising rents. And so one of the things that we are trying to figure out in the community that I've been involved in is how can we put the appropriate safety nets in place to make it possible for the long-term residents, the women and men and the families that have been living there for, I want to say centuries, and in some cases it is centuries, if you look at the history of those communities. And how can you provide opportunities for a healthy development? Because everybody wants healthy development, But how can you do that without driving people out of their own communities? That's the challenge. As I like to say, development without displacement. Is that possible? Certainly, in the community I'm working in, we're trying to make it happen in that way. But that's the challenge. And we think, if we think about income inequality, certainly connected to racial inequality, we understand that these things are linked.
Well, certainly perception may be the biggest thing to overcome. And how do you overcome perception? I mean, one of the statistics in your book was that in a survey, whites indicate that the larger the hypothetical black population is in an area, the more likely white respondents were to express discomfort about living in the same neighborhood. And then there's the black flight that went into the suburbs. So how do you overcome perceptions that actually tend to kind of lead into economic realities?
I think we have to challenge the stereotypes that all of us have been exposed to. At the opening, you know, in your opening comments, you made reference to being, we played that clip where I was talking about being mm-hmm. a smog breather. You know, if we understand that we all get misinformation about people different from ourselves, that that misinformation comes to us through stereotypes that we see in the media, through the jokes we hear people tell, through the language we hear, if we understand that those stereotypes lead us to be afraid of others, then we have to challenge those stereotypes and we have to question the legitimacy of them. If we are willing and able to do that, then we are less afraid. If we're not afraid, then we don't have to move, you know? Mm-hmm. So these are the questions that we have to challenge ourselves on. As I said at the beginning, you know, we understand that the air is smoggy. It's full of this misinformation. Our question has to be, what are we doing individually and collectively to clean up the air? And that's really one of the, I think, the hopeful points in my book, is that we all have the capacity to take action that helps to clean that air up.
Name one. Just give us, better yet, three.
Okay. Well, one of the things I talk a lot about in the book, particularly for those who are working in the higher ed space, is the value of intergroup dialogue. Intergroup dialogue is a strategy that some colleges and universities are beginning to use, which allows young people who have come from different backgrounds to be in the same classroom, engaging in specific tools of dialogue, which include listening carefully to the other person. Understand it's not about debate. It's not about, you know, who can out-talk the other. But how do I listen carefully to you to learn something about your experience and your not only your daily experience of living your life, but your daily experience with racism, your daily experience with sexism, your daily experience with homophobia, whatever the issues are that we might be talking about. And that if you engage in those conversations, which are often uncomfortable at first, but do that over several weeks, you start to build connections with people who are different from yourself and have an understanding about social issues that allow you to begin to feel less defensive and begin to build the kind of bridges that allow you to take effective action against those injustices. That's one example. A very concrete example, you might say, your listeners might say, well, I'm not in college and I don't have an intergroup dialogue course available to me. There's an example in my book of something called the Atlanta Friendship Initiative. This is something that anyone could do, but it was started by two people in Atlanta, one white, one black, two men, who decided that they were going to get to know each other better and invite other pairs of people who are different from one another, different racially, perhaps different in other ways, religiously, and invite them to be intentional in developing a friendship with someone who's different from themselves, and with the intent that as those friendships build, there will be bridges of allies who will work together to bring about positive change in the community. If people are interested in learning more about the Atlanta Friendship Initiative, they have a website, and you can visit it, atlantafriendshipinitiative.com. But what I like about this example, and one of the reasons I included it in my book, is because it didn't require a change in public policy. It didn't require a big budget. It was simply two people interested in making a change, using their spheres of influence to do it. And that, I think, at the end of the day, is what each of us can ask. What's my sphere of influence, and how can I use it to bring about the kind of change I want to see in my community?
It does, however, require people stepping outside their comfort zone.
Absolutely.
And the more toxic the air, the more of a challenge that appears to me. I mean, to kind of continue the analogy of the airport, putting on your mask first so that you can maybe have an idea of how to proceed when the air around you is toxic, it's just a big ask. We're just all human, right? So how do you get people to step out, which is what apparently it's going to require?
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves, what is the discomfort we're experiencing right now? I know for a lot of my colleagues and friends, the watching our society become more divisive, watching our dialogue become more conflict-driven is not a comfortable experience. The fact of the matter is that we pay a cost, each of us, pays a price for the racism in our society. We pay a price when young people don't have access to a high-quality education. We pay a price, quite literally, when we are sending people into prison rather than into education or college. It costs much more to incarcerate people. Mass incarceration is one of the issues I talk about in the book. Costs much more to incarcerate people than it does to send them to college. If we think about the ways in which we are losing the potential, human potential, because of our separation from one another, it's not a comfortable experience that we're having. We're not always aware of how uncomfortable we are. But once we start to recognize the discomfort that comes from the kinds of isms that are operating in our society, it helps motivate us to want to take a change, make a change, risk the discomfort to make a change.
But you can't argue the fact that there are some people who actually feel validated by this environment somehow, right?
Well, there's no question, you know, that you can't change everyone's heart or mind. Mm-hmm. I'm not so naive to suggest that you can. But sometimes when people say to me, Dr. Tatum, you're speaking to the choir, I like to say the choir needs rehearsal. And when the choir sings well, other people want to join. So I think that each of us can be part of a choir that is learning to sing better. And when we do, we inspire others to join us.
When I read your very well-researched and well-written book, I must say I was looking for hope. I was turning every page hoping that there was some way that we could look at where we are and figure out what's next. And in talking to you briefly before the program, you said that there is a this isn't the first time this has happened in America, and you use Reconstruction as an example of perhaps where we thought we were making progress and were lurched backward, but somehow we clawed our way out. Can you just kind of give what's happening today some historical context in that way?
Absolutely. If we think about the arc of history in the United States and elsewhere, what you often see are two steps forward, one step back. You make progress toward a more inclusive society, and then there's resistance against that. There are forces of resistance. And so I think that's what we see here. We have seen progress during the civil rights era, perhaps culminating in the election of President Obama, and now we are seeing the backlash against some of that progress. There was a time period after slavery during Reconstruction, particularly in the South, where there was progress. Black people could vote. Black representatives were elected. There were schools established. It was a period of economic advancement for a disenfranchised group of people. And then much of that got squashed during the backlash against that period of time. But then, of course, we can point to forward progress that emerged during the civil rights era. I read an article shortly after the election of Donald Trump. And it was titled something like, "What Would the Abolitionists Do in the Age of Trump?" And it spoke to the fact that, you know, there have been times when progressive movements have felt setbacks. the abolitionists felt setbacks. And what did they do? They reorganized and they went door to door, talking to neighbors, talking to friends about what was so important about the abolition of slavery, why that was necessary for the nation's well-being and future. And so in the same way, I think, when we look at some of the social issues that we see happening today, we have to say, how can I use my sphere of influence to talk to the people I know, who care about me, to understand that we can make a change if we use our spheres of influence to do so. I end the book with an epilogue, which is titled Signs of Hope, Sights of Progress, because many people feel discouraged right at this moment, but yet there are communities, there are people and places all across the country where people are making positive change, and I wanted to lift up some of those examples so that we can be inspired to keep moving forward.
When some of the things that are happening now have implications 20 or 30 years down the road with the appointment of judges,
absolutely.
Will that change the strategy at all, do you think?
Well, you know, I think that we have to recognize that elections have consequences. And when someone is elected president, they make appointments, and that is what we see happen today. Unfortunately, President Obama was blocked, as we know, by a Republican Congress from filling in that seat, that Supreme Court seat that should have been his to fill, etc. That said, I always come back to voting matters. I read a statistic recently that, you know, while President Trump won with 30% of the vote, there were 40% of people who didn't vote at all. So we all need to pay attention to the importance of voting.
So don't feel hopeless, don't feel helpless, and don't be concerned that black kids are still sitting together in the cafeteria. Is that the message?
Well, I would say this about that question very specifically. Mm-hmm. We should not be surprised that black kids are sitting together in the cafeteria, given the race-conscious society we live in. But our question should not be who's sitting together at lunchtime, but what's happening outside of lunch? What's happening in the classroom? What are we doing to help young people of all backgrounds learn how to engage effectively with people different from themselves? That's a classroom activity. And when we do that well, they will mix across lines in the cafeteria.
It's a great read. It's a great book. And I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thank you so much, Dr. Beverly Tatum, for being here. We're going to leave it there. We've been talking with psychologist and president emerita of Spelman College, Dr. Beverly Tatum, about her revised and updated book, Why Are All the Black Kids Sitting Together in the Cafeteria? And Other Conversations About Race. Dr. Tatum will be speaking tomorrow, Friday, December 1st, at Books, Inc. in Berkeley at 7 o'clock. You can find details at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for joining us, and thank you to the listeners for tuning in. Sorry we couldn't get to all of you. Coming up tomorrow, we're talking net neutrality on the Media Roundtable. Your Call is produced at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for the podcast, visit yourcallradio.org.